This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Wheat Belly. Lose the wheat, lose the weight, and find your path back to health. By William Davis, M.D. For Dawn, Bill, Lauren, and Jacob, my companions on this wheat-free journey. Introduction. Flip through your parents' or grandparents' family albums, and you're likely to be struck by how thin everyone looks. The women probably wore size 4 dresses, and the men sported 32-inch waists. Overweight was something measured only by a few pounds, obesity rare. Overweight children? Almost never. Any 42-inch waists? Not here. 200-pound teenagers? Certainly not. Why were the June Cleavers of the 50s and 60s, the stay-at-home housewives, as well as other people of that era, so much skinnier than the modern people we see at the beach, mall, or in our own mirrors? While women of that era typically weighed in at 110 or 115 pounds, men at 150 or 165 pounds, today we carry 50, 75, even 200 pounds more. The women of that world didn't exercise much at all. It was considered unseemly, after all, like having impure thoughts at church. How many times did you see your mom put on her jogging shoes to go out for a 3-mile run? Exercise for my mother was vacuuming the stairs. Nowadays, I go outdoors on any nice day and see dozens of women jogging, riding their bicycles, power walking, things we'd virtually never see 40 or 50 years ago. And yet, we're getting fatter and fatter every year. My wife is a triathlete and triathlon instructor, so I observe a few of these extreme exercise events every year. Triathletes train intensively for months to years before a race to complete a 1 to 2.5 mile open water swim, a 56 to 112-mile bike ride, and finish with a 13 to 26-mile run. Just completing a race is a feat in itself, since the event requires up to several thousand calories and spectacular endurance. The majority of triathletes adhere to fairly healthy eating habits. Then why are a third of these dedicated men and women athletes overweight? I give them even greater credit for having to cart around the extra 30, 40, or 50 pounds. But given their extreme level of sustained activity and demanding training schedule, how can they still be overweight? If we follow conventional logic, overweight triathletes need to exercise more or eat less to lose weight. I believe that is a downright ridiculous notion. I am going to argue that the problem with the diet and health of most Americans is not fat, not sugar, not the rise of the internet and the demise of the agrarian lifestyle. It's wheat, or what we are being sold that is called wheat. You will see that what we are eating, cleverly disguised as a bran muffin or onion ciabatta, is not really wheat at all, but the transformed product of genetic research conducted during the latter half of the 20th century. Modern wheat is no more real wheat than a chimpanzee is an approximation of a human. While our hairy primate relatives share 99% of all genes found in humans, with longer arms, full body hair, and lesser capacity to win the jackpot at Jeopardy, I trust you can readily tell the difference that 1% makes. Compared to its ancestor of only 40 years ago, modern wheat isn't even that close. I believe that the increased consumption of grains, or more accurately, the increased consumption of this genetically altered thing called modern wheat, explains the contrast between slender, sedentary people of the 50s and overweight 21st century people, triathletes included. I recognize that declaring wheat a malicious food is like declaring that Ronald Reagan was a communist. It may seem absurd, even unpatriotic, to demote an iconic dietary staple to the status of public health hazard. But I will make the case that the world's most popular grain is also the world's most destructive dietary ingredient. Documented peculiar effects of wheat on humans include appetite stimulation, exposure to brain-active exorphins, the counterpart of internally derived endorphins, exaggerated blood sugar surges that trigger cycles of satiety, alternating with heightened appetite, the process of glycation that underlies disease and aging, inflammatory and pH effects that erode cartilage and damage bone, and activation of disordered immune responses. A complex range of diseases results from consumption of wheat, from celiac disease, the devastating intestinal disease that develops from exposure to wheat gluten, to an assortment of neurological disorders, diabetes, heart disease, arthritis, curious rashes, and the paralyzing delusions of schizophrenia. If this thing called wheat is such a problem, then removing it should yield outsize and unexpected benefits. Indeed, that is the case. As a cardiologist who sees and treats thousands of patients at risk for heart disease, diabetes, and the myriad destructive effects of obesity, I have personally observed protuberant, flop-over-the-belt belly fat vanish when my patients eliminated wheat from their diets, with typical weight loss totaling 20, 30, or 50 pounds just within the first few months. Rapid and effortless weight loss is usually followed by health benefits that continue to amaze me, even today, after having witnessed this phenomenon thousands of times. I've seen dramatic turnarounds in health, such as the 38-year-old woman with ulcerative colitis facing colon removal who was cured with wheat elimination, colon intact, or the 26-year-old man incapacitated and barely able to walk because of joint pain who experienced complete relief and walked and ran freely again after taking wheat off the menu. Extraordinary as these results may sound, there is ample scientific research to implicate wheat as the root cause of these conditions, and to indicate that removal of wheat can reduce or relieve symptoms entirely. You will see that we have unwittingly traded convenience, abundance, and low cost for health, with wheat bellies, bulging thighs, and double chins to prove it. Many of the arguments I make in the chapters that follow have been proven in scientific studies that are available for one and all to review. Incredibly, many of the lessons I've learned were demonstrated in clinical studies decades ago, but somehow never percolated to the surface of medical or public consciousness. I've simply put two and two together to come up with some conclusions that you may find startling. It's not your fault. In the movie Good Will Hunting, Matt Damon's character, possessing uncommon genius but harboring demons of past abuse, breaks down in sobs when psychologist Sean McGuire, Robin Williams, repeats, "It's not your fault," over and over again. Likewise, too many of us, stricken with an unsightly wheat belly, blame ourselves. Too many calories, too little exercise, too little restraint. But it's more accurate to say that the advice we've been given to eat more healthy whole grains has deprived us of control over appetites and impulses, making us fat and unhealthy despite our best efforts and good intentions. I liken the widely accepted advice to eat healthy whole grains to telling an alcoholic that if a drink or two won't hurt, 9 or 10 may be even better. Taking this advice has disastrous repercussions on health. It's not your fault. If you find yourself carrying around a protuberant, uncomfortable wheat belly, unsuccessfully trying to squeeze into last year's jeans, reassuring your doctor that, no, you haven't been eating badly, but you're still overweight and pre-diabetic with high blood pressure and cholesterol, or desperately trying to conceal a pair of humiliating man breasts, consider saying goodbye to wheat. Eliminate the wheat. Eliminate the problem. What have you got to lose except your wheat belly, your man breasts, or your bagel butt? Part 1. Wheat, the unhealthy whole grain. Chapter 1. What belly? In centuries past, a prominent belly was the domain of the privileged, a mark of wealth and success, a symbol of not having to clean your own stables or plow your own field. In this century, you don't have to plow your own field. Today, obesity has been democratized. Everybody can have a big belly. Your dad called his rudimentary mid-20th century equivalent a beer belly. But what are soccer moms, kids, and half of your friends and neighbors who don't drink beer doing with a beer belly? I call it wheat belly, though I could have just as easily called this condition pretzel brain, or bagel bowel, or biscuit face, since there's not an organ system unaffected by wheat. But wheat's impact on the waistline is its most visible and defining characteristic, an outward expression of the grotesque distortions humans experience with consumption of this grain. A wheat belly represents the accumulation of fat that results from years of consuming foods that trigger insulin, the hormone of fat storage. While some people store fat in their buttocks and thighs, most people collect ungainly fat around the middle. This central or visceral fat is unique. Unlike fat in other body areas, it provokes inflammatory phenomena, distorts insulin responses, and issues abnormal metabolic signals to the rest of the body. In the unwitting wheat-bellied male, visceral fat also produces estrogen, creating man breasts. The consequences of wheat consumption, however, are not just manifested on the body's surface. Wheat can also reach deep down into virtually every organ of the body, from the intestines, liver, heart, and thyroid gland, all the way up to the brain. In fact, there's hardly an organ that is not affected by wheat in some potentially damaging way. Panting and sweating in the heartland. I practice preventive cardiology in Milwaukee. Like many other Midwestern cities, Milwaukee is a good place to live and raise a family. City services work pretty well. The libraries are first rate. My kids go to quality public schools. And the population is just large enough to enjoy big city culture, such as an excellent symphony and art museum. The people living here are a fairly friendly bunch, but they're fat. I don't mean a little bit fat. I mean really, really fat. I mean panting and sweating after one flight of stairs fat. I mean 240-pound 18-year-old women, SUVs tipped sharply to the driver's side, double-wide wheelchairs, hospital equipment unable to accommodate patients who tip the scales at 350 pounds or more. Not only can't they fit into the CT scanner or other imaging device, you wouldn't be able to see anything even if they could. It's like trying to determine whether the image in the murky ocean water is a flounder or a shark. Once upon a time, an individual weighing 250 pounds or more was a rarity. Today, it's a common sight among the men and women walking the mall, as humdrum as selling jeans at the Gap. Retired people are overweight or obese, as are middle-aged adults, young adults, teenagers, even children. White-collar workers are fat. Blue-collar workers are fat. The sedentary are fat, and so are athletes. White people are fat. Black people are fat. Hispanics are fat. Asians are fat. Carnivores are fat. Vegetarians are fat. Americans are plagued by obesity on a scale never before seen in the human experience. No demographic has escaped the weight gain crisis. Ask the USDA or the Surgeon General's office, and they will tell you that Americans are fat because they drink too many soft drinks, eat too many potato chips, drink too much beer, and don't exercise enough. And those things may indeed be true, but that's hardly the whole story. Many overweight people, in fact, are quite health conscious. Ask anyone tipping the scales over 250 pounds. What do you think happened to allow such incredible weight gain? You may be surprised at how many do not say, "I drink big gulps, eat Pop-Tarts, and watch TV all day." Most will say something like, "I don't get it. I exercise 5 days a week. I've cut my fat and increased my healthy whole grains, yet I can't seem to stop gaining weight." How did we get here? The national trend to reduce fat and cholesterol intake and increase carbohydrate calories has created a peculiar situation in which products made from wheat have not just increased their presence in our diets, they have come to dominate our diets. For most Americans, every single meal and snack contains foods made with wheat flour. It might be the main course, it might be the side dish, it might be the dessert, and it's probably all of them. Wheat has become the national icon of health. Eat more healthy whole grains, we're told. And the food industry happily jumped on board, creating heart-healthy versions of all our favorite wheat products, chock-full of whole grains. The sad truth is that the proliferation of wheat products in the American diet parallels the expansion of our wastes. Advice to cut fat and cholesterol intake and replace the calories with whole grains that was issued by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute through its National Cholesterol Education Program in 1985 coincides precisely with the start of a sharp upward climb in body weight for men and women. Ironically, 1985 also marks the year when the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, began tracking body weight statistics, tidily documenting the explosion in obesity and diabetes that began that very year. Of all the grains in the human diet, why only pick on wheat? Because wheat, by a considerable margin, is the dominant source of gluten protein in the human diet. Unless they're Ewell Gibbons, most people don't eat much rye, barley, spelt, triticale, bulgur, kamut, or other less common gluten sources. Wheat consumption overshadows consumption of other gluten-containing grains by more than 100 to 1. Wheat also has unique attributes those other grains do not, attributes that make it especially destructive to our health, which I will cover in later chapters. But I focus on wheat because in the vast majority of American diets, gluten exposure can be used interchangeably with wheat exposure. For that reason, I often use wheat to signify all gluten-containing grains. The health impact of Triticum aestivum, common bread wheat, and its genetic brethren ranges far and wide, with curious effects from mouth to anus, brain to pancreas, Appalachian housewife to Wall Street arbitrageur. If it sounds crazy, bear with me. I make these claims with a clear, wheat-free conscience. Nutrigrone. Like most children of my generation, born in the middle of the 20th century and reared on Wonder Bread and Devil Dogs, I have a long and close personal relationship with wheat. My sisters and I were veritable connoisseurs of breakfast cereal, making our own individual blends of Trix, Lucky Charms, and Fruit Loops, and eagerly drinking the sweet, pastel-hued milk that remained at the bottom of the bowl. The great American processed food experience didn't end at breakfast, of course. For school lunch, my mom usually packed peanut butter or bologna sandwiches, the prelude to cellophane-wrapped ho-hos and scooter pies. Sometimes she would throw in a few Oreos or Vienna fingers, too. For supper, we loved the TV dinners that came packaged in their own foil plates, allowing us to consume our battered chicken, corn muffin, and apple brown Betty while watching Get Smart. My first year of college, armed with an all-you-can-eat dining room ticket, I gorged on waffles and pancakes for breakfast, fettuccine Alfredo for lunch, pasta with Italian bread for dinner. Poppy seed muffin or angel food cake for dessert? You bet. Not only did I gain a hefty spare tire around the middle at age 19, I felt exhausted all the time. For the next 20 years, I battled this effect, drinking gallons of coffee, struggling to shake off the pervasive stupor that persisted no matter how many hours I slept each night. Yet none of this really registered until I caught sight of a photo of my wife snapped of me while on vacation with our kids, then ages 10, 8, and 4, on Marco Island, Florida. It was 1999. In the picture, I was fast asleep on the sand, my flabby abdomen splayed to either side, my second chin resting on my crossed, flabby arms. That's when it really hit me. I didn't just have a few extra pounds to lose. I had a good 30 pounds of accumulated weight around my middle. What must my patients be thinking when I counseled them on diet? I was no better than the doctors of the 60s, puffing on Marlboros while advising their patients to live healthier lives. Why did I have those extra pounds under my belt? After all, I jogged 3 to 5 miles every day, ate a sensible, balanced diet that didn't include excessive quantities of meats or fats, avoided junk foods and snacks, and instead concentrated on getting plenty of healthy whole grains. What was going on here? Sure, I had my suspicions. I couldn't help but notice that on the days when I'd eat toast, waffles, or bagels for breakfast, I'd stumble through several hours of sleepiness and lethargy. But eat a 3-egg omelet with cheese, feel fine. Some basic laboratory work, though, really stopped me in my tracks. Triglycerides, 350 milligrams per deciliter. HDL, good cholesterol, 27 milligrams per deciliter. And I was diabetic, with a fasting blood sugar of 161 milligrams per deciliter. Jogging nearly every day, but I was overweight and diabetic? Something had to be fundamentally wrong with my diet. Of all the changes I had made in my diet in the name of health, boosting my intake of healthy whole grains had been the most significant. Could it be that the grains were actually making me fatter? That moment of flabby realization began the start of a journey, following the trail of crumbs back from being overweight, and all the health problems that came with it. But it was when I observed even greater effects on a larger scale beyond my own personal experience that I became convinced that there really was something interesting going on. Lessons from a Wheat-Free Experiment. An interesting fact. Whole wheat bread, glycemic index 72, increases blood sugar as much as or more than table sugar, or sucrose, glycemic index 59. Glucose increases blood sugar to 100, hence a glycemic index of 100. The extent to which a particular food increases blood sugar relative to glucose determines that food's glycemic index. So when I was devising a strategy to help my overweight, diabetes-prone patients reduce blood sugar most efficiently, it made sense to me that the quickest and simplest way to get results would be to eliminate the foods that cause their blood sugar to rise most profoundly. In other words, not sugar, but wheat. I provided a simple handout detailing how to replace wheat-based foods with other low-glycemic whole foods to create a healthy diet. After 3 months, my patients returned to have more blood work done. As I had anticipated, with only rare exceptions, blood sugar, glucose, had indeed often dropped from diabetic range, 126 milligrams per deciliter or greater, to normal. Yes, diabetics became non-diabetics. That's right. Diabetes in many cases can be cured, not simply managed, by removal of carbohydrates, especially wheat, from the diet. Many of my patients had also lost 20, 30, even 40 pounds. But it's what I didn't expect that astounded me. They reported that symptoms of acid reflux disappeared, and the cyclic cramping and diarrhea of irritable bowel syndrome were gone. Their energy improved, they had greater focus, sleep was deeper. Rashes disappeared, even rashes that had been present for many years. Their rheumatoid arthritis pain improved, or disappeared, enabling them to cut back, even eliminate, the nasty medications used to treat it. Asthma symptoms improved, or resolved completely, allowing many to throw away their inhalers. Athletes reported more consistent performance. Thinner, more energetic, clearer thinking, better bowel, joint, and lung health. Time and time again. Surely these results were reason enough to forego wheat. What convinced me further were the many instances in which people removed wheat, then permitted themselves a wheat indulgence, a couple of pretzels, a canapé at a cocktail party. Within minutes, many would experience diarrhea, joint swelling and pain, or wheezing. On again, off again, the phenomenon would repeat itself. What started out as a simple experiment in reducing blood sugars exploded into an insight into multiple health conditions and weight loss that continues to amaze me, even today. A radical wheatectomy. For many, the idea of removing wheat from the diet is, at least psychologically, as painful as the thought of having a root canal without anesthesia. For some, the process can indeed have uncomfortable side effects, akin to withdrawal from cigarettes or alcohol. But this procedure must be performed to permit the patient to recover. Wheat Belly explores the proposition that the health problems of Americans, from fatigue to arthritis to gastrointestinal distress to obesity, originate with the innocent-looking bran muffin or cinnamon raisin bagel you down with your coffee every morning. The good news, there is a cure for this condition called Wheat Belly, or if you prefer, pretzel brain, bagel bowel, or biscuit face. The bottom line, elimination of this food, part of human culture for more centuries than Larry King was on the air, will make you sleeker, smarter, faster, and happier. Weight loss, in particular, can proceed at a pace you didn't think possible, and you can selectively lose the most visible, insulin-opposing, diabetes-creating, inflammation-producing, embarrassment-causing fat, belly fat. It is a process accomplished with virtually no hunger or deprivation, with a wide spectrum of health benefits. So why eliminate wheat rather than, say, sugar or all grains in general? The next chapter will explain why wheat is unique among modern grains in its ability to convert quickly to blood sugar. In addition, it has a poorly understood and understudied genetic makeup and addictive properties that actually cause us to overeat even more, has been linked to literally dozens of debilitating ailments beyond those associated with overweight, and has infiltrated almost every aspect of our diet. Sure, cutting out refined sugar is probably a good idea, as it provides little or no nutritional benefit and will also impact your blood sugar in a negative way. But for the most bang for your buck, eliminating wheat is the easiest and most effective step you can take to safeguard your health and trim your waistline. Chapter 2. Not Your Grandma's Muffins. The creation of modern wheat. Wheat, more than any other foodstuff, including sugar, fat, and salt, is woven into the fabric of the American food experience, a trend that began even before Ozzie met Harriet. It has become such a ubiquitous part of the American diet in so many ways that it seems essential to our lifestyle. What would a plate of eggs be without toast, lunch without sandwiches, beer without pretzels, picnics without hot dog buns, dip without crackers, hummus without pita, lox without bagels, apple pie without the crust? If it's Tuesday, it must be wheat. I once measured the length of the bread aisle at my local supermarket, 68 feet. That's 68 feet of white bread, whole wheat bread, multigrain bread, seven-grain bread, rye bread, pumpernickel bread, sourdough bread, Italian bread, French bread, breadsticks, white bagels, raisin bagels, cheese bagels, garlic bagels, oat bread, flax bread, pita bread, dinner rolls, Kaiser rolls, poppy seed rolls, hamburger buns, and 14 varieties of hot dog buns. That's not even counting the bakery, and the additional 40 feet of shelves packed with a variety of artisanal wheat products. And then there's the snack aisle, with 40-some brands of crackers and 27 brands of pretzels. The baking aisle has breadcrumbs and croutons. The dairy case has dozens of those tubes you crack open to bake rolls, Danish, and crescents. Breakfast cereals fill a world unto themselves, usually enjoying a monopoly over an entire supermarket aisle, top to bottom shelf. There's much of an aisle devoted to boxes and bags of pasta and noodles, spaghetti, lasagna, penne, elbows, shells, whole wheat pasta, green spinach pasta, orange tomato pasta, egg noodles, tiny grain couscous to 3-inch wide pasta sheets. How about frozen foods? The freezer has hundreds of noodle, pasta, and wheat-containing side dishes to accompany the meatloaf and roast beef au jus. In fact, apart from the detergent and soap aisle, there's barely a shelf that doesn't contain wheat products. Can you blame Americans if they've allowed wheat to dominate their diets? After all, it's in practically everything. Wheat as a crop has succeeded on an unprecedented scale, exceeded only by corn in acreage of farmland planted. It is, by a long stretch, among the most consumed grains on earth, constituting 20% of all calories consumed. And wheat has been an undeniable financial success. How many other ways can a manufacturer transform a nickel's worth of raw material into $3.99 worth of glitzy, consumer-friendly product, topped off with endorsements from the American Heart Association? In most cases, the cost of marketing these products exceeds the cost of the ingredients themselves. Foods made partly or entirely of wheat for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks have become the rule. Indeed, such a regimen would make the USDA, the Whole Grains Council, the Whole Wheat Council, the American Dietetic Association, the American Diabetes Association, and the American Heart Association happy, knowing that their message to eat more healthy whole grains has gained a wide and eager following. So why has this seemingly benign plant that sustained generations of humans suddenly turned on us? For one thing, it is not the same grain our forebears ground into their daily bread. Wheat naturally evolved to only a modest degree over the centuries, but it has changed dramatically in the past 50 years under the influence of agricultural scientists. Wheat strains have been hybridized, crossbred, and introgressed to make the wheat plant resistant to environmental conditions, such as drought, or pathogens, such as fungi. But most of all, genetic changes have been induced to increase yield per acre. The average yield on a modern North American farm is more than tenfold greater than farms of a century ago. Such enormous strides in yield have required drastic changes in genetic code, including reducing the proud amber waves of grain of yesteryear to the rigid 18-inch tall high-production dwarf wheat of today. Such fundamental genetic changes, as you will see, have come at a price. Even in the few decades since your grandmother survived Prohibition and danced the Big Apple, wheat has undergone countless transformations. As the science of genetics has progressed over the past 50 years, permitting human intervention at a much more rapid rate than nature's slow year-by-year breeding influence, the pace of change has increased exponentially. The genetic backbone of your high-tech poppy seed muffin has achieved its current condition by a process of evolutionary acceleration that makes us look like Homo habilis trapped somewhere in the early Pleistocene. From Natufian porridge to donut holes. Give us this day our daily bread. It's in the Bible. In Deuteronomy, Moses describes the promised land as a land of wheat and barley and vineyards. Bread is central to religious ritual. Jews celebrate Passover with unleavened matzah to commemorate the flight of the Israelites from Egypt. Christians consume wafers representing the body of Christ. Muslims regard unleavened naan as sacred, insisting it be stored upright and never thrown away in public. In the Bible, bread is a metaphor for bountiful harvest, a time of plenty, freedom from starvation, even salvation. Don't we break bread with friends and family? Isn't something new and wonderful the best thing since sliced bread? Taking the bread out of someone's mouth is to deprive that person of a fundamental necessity. Bread is a nearly universal diet staple. Chapati in India, soriki in Greece, pita in the Middle East, ebeskewer in Denmark, nanbia for breakfast in Burma, glazed donuts any old time in the United States. The notion that a foodstuff so fundamental, so deeply ingrained in the human experience, can be bad for us is, well, unsettling and counter to long-held cultural views of wheat and bread. But today's bread bears little resemblance to the loaves that emerged from our forebears' ovens. Just as a modern Napa Cabernet Sauvignon is a far cry from the crude ferment of 4th century BC Georgian winemakers who buried wine urns in underground mounds, so has wheat changed. Bread and other foods made of wheat have sustained humans for centuries, but the wheat of our ancestors is not the same as modern commercial wheat that reaches your breakfast, lunch, and dinner table. From the original strains of wild grass harvested by early humans, wheat has exploded to more than 25,000 varieties, virtually all of them the result of human intervention. In the waning days of the Pleistocene, around 8500 BC, millennia before any Christian, Jew, or Muslim walked the earth, before the Egyptian, Greek, and Roman empires, the Natufians led a semi-nomadic life roaming the Fertile Crescent, now Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Israel, and Iraq, supplementing their hunting and gathering by harvesting indigenous plants. They harvested the ancestor of modern wheat, einkorn, from fields that flourished wildly in open plains. Meals of gazelle, boar, fowl, and ibex were rounded out with dishes of wild-growing grain and fruit. Relics like those excavated at the Tel Abu Huraira settlement in what is now central Syria suggest skilled use of tools such as sickles and mortars to harvest and grind grains, as well as storage pits for stockpiling harvested food. Remains of harvested wheat have been found at archaeological digs in Tel Aswad, Jericho, Nahal Himar, Navali Kori, and other locales. Wheat was ground by hand, then eaten as porridge. The modern concept of bread leavened by yeast would not come along for several thousand years. Natufians harvested wild einkorn wheat and may have purposefully stored seeds to sow in areas of their own choosing the next season. Einkorn wheat eventually became an essential component of the Natufian diet, reducing the need for hunting and gathering. The shift from harvesting wild grain to cultivating it was a fundamental change that shaped their subsequent migratory behavior, as well as the development of tools, language, and culture. It marked the beginning of agriculture, a lifestyle that required long-term commitment to more or less permanent settlement, a turning point in the course of human civilization. Growing grains and other foods yielded a surplus of food that allowed for occupational specialization, government, and all the elaborate trappings of culture, while in contrast, the absence of agriculture arrested cultural development at something resembling Neolithic life. Over most of the 10,000 years that wheat has occupied a prominent place in the caves, huts, and adobes, and on the tables of humans, what started out as harvested einkorn, then emmer, followed by cultivated triticum aestivum, changed gradually and only in small fits and starts. The wheat of the 17th century was the wheat of the 18th century, which in turn was much the same as the wheat of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century. Riding your ox cart through the countryside during any of these centuries, you'd see fields of 4-foot-tall amber waves of grain swaying in the breeze. Crude human wheat breeding efforts yielded hit-and-miss, year-over-year incremental modifications, some successful, most not, and even a discerning eye would be hard-pressed to tell the difference between the wheat of early 20th century farming from its many centuries of predecessors. During the 19th and early 20th centuries, as in many preceding centuries, wheat changed little. The Pillsbury's Best XXXX flour my grandmother used to make her famous sour cream muffins in 1940 was little different from the flour of her great-grandmother 60 years earlier, or, for that matter, from that of a relative 2 centuries before that. Grinding of wheat had become more mechanized in the 20th century, yielding finer flour on a larger scale, but the basic composition of the flour remained much the same. That all ended in the latter part of the 20th century, when an upheaval in hybridization methods transformed this grain. What now passes for wheat has changed, not through the forces of drought or disease or a Darwinian scramble for survival, but through human intervention. As a result, wheat has undergone a more drastic transformation than Joan Rivers, stretched, sowed, cut, and stitched back together to yield something entirely unique, nearly unrecognizable when compared to the original, and yet still called by the same name, wheat. Modern commercial wheat production has been intent on delivering features such as increased yield, decreased production costs, and large-scale production of a consistent commodity. All the while, virtually no questions have been asked about whether these features are compatible with human health. I submit that, somewhere along the way during wheat's history, perhaps 5,000 years ago, but more likely 50 years ago, wheat changed. The result? A loaf of bread, biscuit, or pancake of today is different than its counterpart of 1,000 years ago, different even from what our grandmothers made. They might look the same, even taste much the same, but there are biochemical differences. Small changes in wheat protein structure can spell the difference between a devastating immune response to wheat protein versus no immune response at all. Wheat before geneticists got hold of it. Wheat is uniquely adaptable to environmental conditions, growing in Jericho, 850 feet below sea level, to Himalayan mountainous regions, 10,000 feet above sea level. Its latitudinal range is also wide, ranging from as far north as Norway, 65 degrees north latitude, to Argentina, 45 degrees south latitude. Wheat occupies 60 million acres of farmland in the United States, an area equal to the state of Ohio. Worldwide, wheat is grown on an area 10 times that figure, or twice the total acreage of Western Europe. The first wild, then cultivated wheat was einkorn, the great-granddaddy of all subsequent wheat. Einkorn has the simplest genetic code of all wheat, containing only 14 chromosomes. Circa 3300 BC, hardy, cold-tolerant einkorn wheat was a popular grain in Europe. This was the age of the Tyrolean Iceman, fondly known as Ötzi. Examination of the intestinal contents of this naturally mummified late Neolithic hunter, killed by attackers and left to freeze in the mountain glaciers of the Italian Alps, revealed the partially digested remains of einkorn wheat consumed as unleavened flatbread, along with remains of plants, deer, and ibex meat. Shortly after the cultivation of the first einkorn plant, the Emmer variety of wheat, the natural offspring of parents einkorn and an unrelated wild grass, Egelof's speltoids, or goat grass, made its appearance in the Middle East. Goat grass added its genetic code to that of einkorn, resulting in the more complex 28-chromosome Emmer wheat. Plants such as wheat have the ability to retain the sum of the genes of their forebears. Imagine that when your parents mated to create you, rather than mixing chromosomes and coming up with 46 chromosomes to create their offspring, they combined 46 chromosomes from mom with 46 chromosomes from dad, totaling 92 chromosomes in you. This, of course, doesn't happen in higher species. Such additive accumulation of chromosomes in plants is called polyploidy. Einkorn and its evolutionary successor, emmer wheat, remained popular for several thousand years, sufficient to earn their places as food staples and religious icons, despite their relatively poor yield and less desirable baking characteristics compared to modern wheat. These denser, cruder flours would have yielded lousy ciabattas or bear claws. Emmer wheat is probably what Moses referred to in his pronouncements, as well as the kusamith mentioned in the Bible, and the variety that persisted up until the dawn of the Roman Empire. Sumerians, credited with developing the first written language, left us tens of thousands of cuneiform tablets. Pictographic characters scrawled on several tablets, dated to 3000 BC, describe recipes for breads and pastries, all made by taking mortar and pestle or a hand-pushed grinding wheel to emmer wheat. Sand was often added to the mixture to hasten the laborious grinding process, leaving bread-eating Sumerians with sand-chipped teeth. Emmer wheat flourished in ancient Egypt, its cycle of growth suited to the seasonal rise and fall of the Nile. Egyptians are credited with learning how to make bread rise by the addition of yeast. When the Jews fled Egypt, in their hurry they failed to take the leavening mixture with them, forcing them to consume unleavened bread made from emmer wheat. Sometime in the millennia predating biblical times, 28-chromosome emmer wheat, Triticum turgidum, mated naturally with another grass, Triticum tautii, yielding primordial 42-chromosome Triticum aestivum, genetically closest to what we now call wheat. Because it contains the sum total of the chromosomal content of three unique plants with 42 chromosomes, it is the most genetically complex. It is therefore the most genetically pliable, an issue that will serve future genetics researchers well in the millennia to come. Over time, the higher-yielding and more baking-compatible Triticum aestivum species gradually overshadowed its parents' einkorn and emmer wheat. For many ensuing centuries, Triticum aestivum wheat changed little. By the mid-18th century, the great Swedish botanist and biological cataloger Carolus Linnaeus, father of the Linnaean system of the categorization of species, counted five different varieties falling under the Triticum genus. Wheat did not evolve naturally in the New World, but was introduced by Christopher Columbus, whose crew first planted a few grains in Puerto Rico in 1493. Spanish explorers accidentally brought wheat seeds in a sack of rice to Mexico in 1530, and later introduced it to the American Southwest. The namer of Cape Cod and discoverer of Martha's Vineyard, Bartholomew Gosnold, first brought wheat to New England in 1602, followed shortly thereafter by the Pilgrims, who transported wheat with them on the Mayflower. And so it went, a gradual expansion of the reach of wheat plants, with only modest and gradual evolutionary selection at work. Today, einkorn, emmer, and the original wild and cultivated strains of Triticum aestivum have been replaced by thousands of modern human-bred offspring of Triticum aestivum, as well as Triticum durum, pasta, and Triticum compactum, very fine flours used to make cupcakes and other products. To find einkorn or emmer today, you'd have to look for the limited wild collections or modest human plantings scattered around the Middle East, southern France, and northern Italy. Courtesy of modern human-designed hybridizations, Triticum species of today are hundreds, perhaps thousands of genes apart from the original einkorn wheat that bred naturally. Triticum wheat of today is the product of breeding to generate greater yield and characteristics such as disease, drought, and heat resistance. In fact, wheat has been modified by humans to such a degree that modern strains are unable to survive in the wild without human support, such as nitrate fertilization and pest control. Imagine this bizarre situation in the world of domesticated animals, an animal able to exist only with human assistance, such as special feed, or else it would die. Differences between the wheat of the Natufians and what we call wheat in the 21st century would be evident to the naked eye. Original einkorn and emmer wheat were hulled forms, in which the seeds clung tightly to the stem. Modern wheats are naked forms, in which the seeds depart from the stem more readily, a characteristic that makes threshing, separating the edible grain from the inedible chaff, easier and more efficient, determined by mutations at the Q and TG, tenacious gloom genes. But other differences are even more obvious. Modern wheat is much shorter. The romantic notion of tall fields of wheat grain gracefully waving in the wind has been replaced by dwarf and semi-dwarf varieties that stand barely a foot or two tall, yet another product of breeding experiments to increase yield. The real wheat. What was the wheat grown 10,000 years ago and harvested by hand from wild fields like? That simple question took me to the Middle East, or more precisely, to a small organic farm in western Massachusetts. There, I found Elisheva Rugosa. Eli is not only a science teacher, but an organic farmer, advocate of sustainable agriculture, and founder of the Heritage Wheat Conservancy, www.growseed.org, an organization devoted to preserving ancient food crops and cultivating them using organic principles. After living in the Middle East for 10 years and working with a Jordanian, Israeli, and Palestinian GenBank project to collect nearly extinct ancient wheat strains, Eli returned to the United States with seeds descended from the original wheat plants of ancient Egypt and Canaan. She has since devoted herself to cultivating the ancient grains that sustained her ancestors. My first contact with Ms. Rugosa began with an exchange of emails that resulted from my request for 2 pounds of einkorn wheat grain. She couldn't stop herself from educating me about her unique crop, which was not just any old wheat grain after all. Eli described the taste of einkorn bread as rich, subtle, with more complex flavor, unlike bread made from modern wheat flour, which she claimed tasted like cardboard. Eli bristles at the suggestion that wheat products might be unhealthy, citing instead the yield-increasing, profit-expanding agricultural practices of the past few decades as the source of adverse health effects of wheat. She views einkorn and emmer as the solution, restoring the original grasses, grown under organic conditions, to replace modern industrial wheat. Small is the new big. For as long as humans have practiced agriculture, farmers have strived to increase yield. Marrying a woman with a dowry of several acres of farmland was, for many centuries, the primary means of increasing crop yield, arrangements often accompanied by several goats and a sack of rice. The 20th century introduced mechanized farm machinery, which replaced animal power and increased efficiency and yield with less manpower, providing another incremental increase in yield per acre. While production in the United States was usually sufficient to meet demand, with distribution limited more by poverty than by supply, many other nations worldwide were unable to feed their populations, resulting in widespread hunger. In modern times, humans have tried to increase yield by creating new strains, crossbreeding different wheats and grasses, and generating new genetic varieties in the laboratory. Hybridization efforts involve techniques such as introgression and backcrossing, in which offspring of plant breeding are mated with their parents, or with different strains of wheat or even other grasses. Such efforts, though first formally described by Austrian priest and botanist Gregor Mendel in 1866, did not begin in earnest until the mid-20th century, when concepts such as heterozygosity and gene dominance were better understood. Since Mendel's early efforts, geneticists have developed elaborate techniques to obtain a desired trait, though much trial and error is still required. Much of the current world supply of purposefully bred wheat is descended from strains developed at the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, IMWIC, located east of Mexico City at the foot of the Sierra Madre Oriental Mountains. IMWIC began as an agricultural research program in 1943 through a collaboration of the Rockefeller Foundation and the Mexican government to help Mexico achieve agricultural self-sufficiency. It grew into an impressive worldwide effort to increase the yield of corn, soy, and wheat, and the admirable goal of reducing world hunger. Mexico provided an efficient proving ground for plant hybridization, since the climate allows 2 growing seasons per year, cutting the time required to hybridize strains by half. By 1980, these efforts had produced thousands of new strains of wheat, the most high-yielding of which have since been adopted worldwide, from third-world countries to modern industrialized nations, including the United States. One of the practical difficulties solved during IMWIC's push to increase yield is that when large quantities of nitrogen-rich fertilizer are applied to wheat fields, the seed head at the top of the plant grows to enormous proportions. The top-heavy seed head, however, buckles the stalk, what agricultural scientists call lodging. Buckling kills the plant and makes harvesting problematic. University of Minnesota-trained geneticist Norman Borlaug, working at IMWIC, is credited with developing the exceptionally high-yielding dwarf wheat that was shorter and stockier, allowing the plant to maintain erect posture and resist buckling under the large seed head. Tall stalks are also inefficient. Short stalks reach maturity more quickly, which means a shorter growing season with less fertilizer required to generate the otherwise useless stalk. Dr. Borlaug's wheat hybridizing accomplishments earned him the title of Father of the Green Revolution in the agricultural community, as well as the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the Congressional Gold Medal, and the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970. On his death in 2009, the Wall Street Journal eulogized him. More than any other single person, Borlaug showed that nature is no match for human ingenuity in setting the real limits to growth. Dr. Borlaug lived to see his dream come true. His high-yield dwarf wheat did indeed help solve world hunger, with the wheat crop yield in China, for example, increasing eightfold from 1961 to 1999. Dwarf wheat today has essentially replaced most other strains of wheat in the United States and much of the world, thanks to its extraordinary capacity for high yield. According to Alan Fritz, Ph.D., professor of wheat breeding at Kansas State University, dwarf and semi-dwarf wheat now comprise more than 99% of all wheat grown worldwide. Bad breeding. The peculiar oversight in the flurry of breeding activity, such as that conducted at IMWIC, was that, despite dramatic changes in the genetic makeup of wheat and other crops, no animal or human safety testing was conducted on the new genetic strains that were created. So intent were the efforts to increase yield, so confident were plant geneticists that hybridization yielded safe products for human consumption, so urgent was the cause of world hunger, that these products of agricultural research were released into the food supply without human safety concerns being part of the equation. It was simply assumed that, because hybridization and breeding efforts yielded plants that remained essentially wheat, new strains would be perfectly well tolerated by the consuming public. Agricultural scientists, in fact, scoff at the idea that hybridization has the potential to generate hybrids that are unhealthy for humans. After all, hybridization techniques have been used, albeit in cruder form, in crops, animals, even humans, for centuries. Mate two varieties of tomatoes. You still get tomatoes, right? What's the problem? The question of animal or human safety testing is never raised. With wheat, it was likewise assumed that variations in gluten content and structure, modifications of other enzymes and proteins, qualities that confer susceptibility or resistance to various plant diseases, would all make their way to humans without consequence. Judging by research findings of agricultural geneticists, such assumptions may be unfounded and just plain wrong. Analyses of proteins expressed by a wheat hybrid compared to its two parent strains have demonstrated that while approximately 95% of the proteins expressed in the offspring are the same, 5% are unique, found in neither parent. Wheat gluten proteins, in particular, undergo considerable structural change with hybridization. In one hybridization experiment, 14 new gluten proteins were identified in the offspring that were not present in either parent wheat plant. Moreover, when compared to century-old strains of wheat, modern strains of Triticum aestivum express a higher quantity of genes for gluten proteins that are associated with celiac disease. Multiply these alterations by the tens of thousands of hybridizations to which wheat has been subjected, and you have the potential for dramatic shifts in genetically determined traits such as gluten structure. And note that the genetic modifications created by hybridization for the wheat plants themselves were essentially fatal, since the thousands of new wheat breeds were helpless when left to grow in the wild, relying on human assistance for survival. The new agriculture of increased wheat yield was initially met with skepticism in the Third World, with objections based mostly on the perennial, "That's not how we used to do it," variety. Dr. Borlaug, hero of wheat hybridization, answered critics of high-yield wheat by blaming explosive world population growth, making high-tech agriculture a necessity. The marvelously increased yields enjoyed in hunger-plagued India, Pakistan, China, Colombia, and other countries quickly quieted naysayers. Yields improved exponentially, turning shortages into surplus and making wheat products cheap and accessible. Can you blame farmers for preferring high-yield dwarf hybrid strains? After all, many small farmers struggle financially. If they can increase yield per acre up to tenfold, with a shorter growing season and easier harvest, why wouldn't they? In the future, the science of genetic modification has the potential to change wheat even further. No longer do scientists need to breed strains, cross their fingers, and hope for just the right mix of chromosomal exchange. Instead, single genes can be purposefully inserted or removed, and strains bred for disease resistance, pesticide resistance, cold or drought tolerance, or any number of other genetically determined characteristics. In particular, new strains can be genetically tailored to be compatible with specific fertilizers or pesticides. This is a financially rewarding process for big agribusiness, and seed and farm chemical producers such as Cargill, Monsanto, and ADM, since specific strains of seed can be patent protected and thereby command a premium and boost sales of the compatible chemical treatments. Genetic modification is built on the premise that a single gene can be inserted in just the right place without disrupting the genetic expression of other characteristics. While the concept seems sound, it doesn't always work out that cleanly. In the first decade of genetic modification, no animal or safety testing was required for genetically modified plants, since the practice was considered no different than the assumed-to-be-benign practice of hybridization. Public pressure has, more recently, caused regulatory agencies, such as the Food Regulating Branch of the FDA, to require testing prior to a genetically modified product's release into the market. Critics of genetic modification, however, have cited studies that identify potential problems with genetically modified crops. Test animals fed glyphosate-tolerant soybeans, known as Roundup Ready. These beans are genetically bred to allow the farmer to freely spray the weed killer Roundup without harming the crop, show alterations in liver, pancreatic, intestinal, and testicular tissue compared to animals fed conventional soybeans. The difference is believed to be due to unexpected DNA rearrangement near the gene insertion site, yielding altered proteins in food with potential toxic effects. It took the introduction of gene modification to finally bring the notion of safety testing for genetically altered plants to light. Public outcry has prompted the international agricultural community to develop guidelines, such as the 2003 Codex Alimentarius, a joint effort by the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations and the World Health Organization, to help determine what new genetically modified crops should be subjected to safety testing, what kinds of tests should be conducted, and what should be measured. But no such outcry was raised years earlier, as farmers and geneticists carried out tens of thousands of hybridization experiments. There is no question that unexpected genetic rearrangements that might generate some desirable property, such as greater drought resistance or better dough properties, can be accompanied by changes in proteins that are not evident to the eye, nose, or tongue. But little effort has focused on these side effects. Hybridization efforts continue, breeding new synthetic wheat. While hybridization falls short of the precision of gene modification techniques, it still possesses the potential to inadvertently turn on or turn off genes unrelated to the intended effect, generating unique characteristics, not all of which are presently identifiable. Thus, the alterations of wheat that could potentially result in undesirable effects on humans are not due to gene insertion or deletion, but are due to the hybridization experiments that predate genetic modification. As a result, over the past 50 years, thousands of new strains have made it to the human commercial food supply without a single effort at safety testing. This is a development with such enormous implications for human health that I will repeat it. Modern wheat, despite all the genetic alterations to modify hundreds, if not thousands, of its genetically determined characteristics, made its way to the worldwide human food supply with nary a question surrounding its suitability for human consumption. Because hybridization experiments did not require the documentation of animal or human testing, pinpointing where, when, and how the precise hybrids that might have amplified the ill effects of wheat is an impossible task, nor is it known whether only some or all of the hybrid wheat generated has potential for undesirable human health effects. The incremental genetic variations introduced with each round of hybridization can make a world of difference. Take human males and females. While men and women are, at their genetic core, largely the same, the differences clearly make for an interesting conversation, not to mention romantic dalliances. The crucial differences between human men and women, a set of differences that originate with just a single chromosome, the diminutive male Y chromosome and its few genes, set the stage for thousands of years of human life and death, Shakespearean drama, and the chasm separating Homer from Marge Simpson. And so it goes with this human-engineered grass we still call wheat. Genetic differences generated via thousands of human-engineered hybridizations make for substantial variation in composition, appearance, and qualities, important not just to chefs and food processors, but also potentially to human health. A good grain gone bad? Given the genetic distance that has evolved between modern-day wheat and its evolutionary predecessors, is it possible that ancient grains such as emmer and einkorn can be eaten without the unwanted effects that attach to other wheat products. I decided to put einkorn to the test, grinding 2 pounds of whole grain to flour, which I then used to make bread. I also ground conventional organic whole wheat flour from seed.